Hey everyone, and welcome to the Revolution Health Radio Show. I'm Steve Wright from scdlifestyle.com, and with me is Chris Kresser, health detective and creator of chriskresser.com. How you doing, man?
Oh, I'm pretty good. How are you, Steve?
I'm good. I got my green tea next to me, and I'm ready to rock and roll.
Nice. All right, let's do it. We have I'm always reading studies that people send them to me. I find them myself. I'm, as many of you know, kind of a research dork. So I found some interesting ones this week, and they're on some themes that I've been writing about and talking about on the show previously and just thinking about a lot myself. So I want to talk a little bit about some of these studies, and then we should have some time to jump into some questions.
Yeah, that sounds like a good plan. And I was just going to let everybody know that if they're new to the paleo diet, or if they're just interested in optimizing their health, they should check out Beyond Paleo. It's a free 13-part email series on burning fat, boosting energy, and preventing and reversing disease without drugs. To sign up, just go to chriskresser.com and look for the giant red box.
All right. So the first study is right in line with the April Best Your Stress Challenge. And if you haven't heard of this, go check out my blog, chriskresser.com. You know, there's a lot of 30-day diet challenges. There's the Whole 30, and there's the Personal Paleo Code, my program, where we ask people to give the paleo diet a try for 30 days and give it the chance to change their lives and make a big difference in their health. I've talked a lot about the importance of stress management and improving stress tolerance to and mitigating the impacts of the stress that we can't get rid of on our life. And so I thought it would be a good idea to spend April doing a 30-day Best Your Stress Challenge. So the idea is to apply that same concept of a 30-day diet challenge to stress management. And I wrote a post about this a little while back, just I think on March 30th. And offered some ideas for what people can do to manage their stress throughout the month of April, and just to make a commitment, and preferably a small, fairly manageable one, because oftentimes we have a tendency to commit to more than we can do, and then we don't follow through. So just setting a small goal, like meditating for 10 minutes in the morning, or doing a deep relaxation exercise every afternoon, or taking a walk in the woods or on the beach. Whatever it is that helps you manage your stress, and doing that throughout the whole month of April and seeing how that improves your health overall. So the other day, I saw a new study with the title Chronic Stress, Glucocorticoid Receptor Resistance, Inflammation, and Disease Risk. And since I've been thinking a lot about stress and the effects of stress on disease, I thought it would be a good idea to talk a little bit about this study, because it's really interesting. And it takes our traditional concept of how stress contributes to disease and kind of turns it on its head. It's some relatively new information. I've seen a few other studies with a similar theme. And if anything, it just reinforces what we've been talking about in terms of the connection between stress and disease and the importance of managing stress and reducing either reducing the symptoms of a disease that we already have, or helping to cure it entirely, or preventing the risk of acquiring a new disease. So stress is associated with just about every modern disease that you can name, from depression to cardiovascular disease to type 2 diabetes to autoimmune conditions like rheumatoid arthritis and Crohn's disease and multiple sclerosis to upper respiratory infections and even the common cold. And up until pretty recently, and still now, I think most people think that stress causes disease by dysregulating the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. But this notion that stress acts simply by elevating cortisol levels is becoming less and less likely, at least in the current scientific literature. So what this new paper and other recent papers suggest is that it's actually the sensitivity of cells or the target tissue to cortisol, not absolute levels of cortisol that's most important. And so glucocorticoid resistance, which is a decrease in sensitivity of immune cells to glucocorticoid hormones like cortisol, shuts off, makes it more difficult to shut off the inflammatory response. So let me break that down. So just like when you're insulin resistant, you're producing enough insulin, but your cells are resistant to the effects of insulin. So it's like insulin's knocking on the door, but nobody's inside, or whoever's inside isn't listening. So the door doesn't get open and insulin can't perform its function. The same is true with leptin resistance. And there's even thyroid hormone resistance, where thyroid hormone can't activate the cellular receptors for thyroid hormone. So even though there's plenty of thyroid hormone circulating around, you experience all the signs and symptoms of hypothyroidism because thyroid hormone isn't affecting the receptor. So this study and others like it suggest that there's a similar phenomenon with cortisol resistance. So it's not high levels of cortisol per se that are contributing to an increased susceptibility of disease, but it's instead the insensitivity of cellular receptors to cortisol that's the problem, because one of cortisol's jobs is to turn off the inflammatory response once it gets started. So let's say you catch a cold or you get a cut or you have some kind of injury or illness that and inflammation is the natural response to that. That inflammation is not all bad. In an acute setting, inflammation is what helps us to heal. The problem happens when inflammation doesn't get turned off appropriately, and then it just kind of runs wild and you get chronic inflammation. And that it's that chronic inflammation that is a risk factor for disease, not the acute inflammation that helps us to heal. So in a normal functioning person, what would happen is that you'd get a cold or you'd get some kind of injury or acute condition that causes inflammation. And then the glucocorticoids, like cortisol, are produced and they turn off the inflammatory response by activating the glucocorticoid receptors. So what these researchers have found is that people who are under chronic stress, that doesn't work right. The cortisol gets secreted, but it doesn't activate the receptors, and then you get a runaway inflammatory response. And this has been shown in other studies. They found that cortisol resistance is present in spouses of brain cancer patients, in parents of children with cancer, and in people that are very lonely. And all of those populations are known to be experiencing significant stress. So in this study, the researchers used, I think, a pretty ingenious model to demonstrate this effect. It's well established that chronic stress increases the susceptibility to the common cold and upper respiratory infections, as I mentioned earlier. So the researchers actually did two studies in one. The first one was meant to determine whether stress causes cortisol resistance and whether people with cortisol resistance are more likely to develop a common cold in the first place. And then the second one is meant to determine whether cortisol resistance could predict the amount of local inflammation in the nose, for example, in response to a viral infection. And so what they did is they actually purposely infected people with a virus, a rhinovirus that causes common cold and respiratory infection. And as expected in the first study, their results did show that exposure to stress increased cortisol resistance. And in the control group, they found that exposure to a stressor an acute stressor was associated with white blood cell count. But in the group that was under chronic stress, there was no association. So in other words, what should happen is that when you're exposed to a stressor, as I mentioned, cortisol should turn off the inflammatory response and reduce the white blood cell count. But that didn't happen in people that were under chronic stress and had cortisol resistance. In the second study, they found a correlation between cortisol resistance and the levels of various pro-inflammatory cytokines locally, like interleukin 6 and TNF-alpha. And then they also saw a decreased sensitivity of white blood cells to the inhibitory effects of cortisol, like we've been talking about. So, in other words, when you're stressed out, the immune system cannot turn off the inflammatory response like it's supposed to. And then you're more likely not only to get sick in the first place, but you're more likely to stay sick for longer because that inflammatory process doesn't get inhibited. So the interesting thing also about this study is that there was no correlation between actual cortisol levels, like circulating cortisol levels, and disease risk or inflammation. So it seems like it's the cellular receptivity to cortisol, the sensitivity of the receptors to the actions of cortisol that's the most important, rather than the circulating levels of cortisol themselves. So I thought that was pretty interesting, and you know, it may not change things from like an end user perspective too much, because the idea is still that you want to take steps to manage your stress. But for me, every study I see like this is just another affirmation of the importance of stress management. And I see it in my work with my patients. I see it in my own life, my own experience. And people might be getting tired of hearing me talk about it, but I'm going to keep talking about it because I think it's kind of the elephant in the room in a lot of cases. In my patient population, I think I can pretty safely say that people who are taking active steps to manage their stress have significantly better clinical outcomes than people who don't. And I just think it's a much bigger contributor to the whole disease process than most of us really realize.
That's pretty insightful, man. And that's I think it's awesome that we're getting more data on what the problem is, because you do hear a lot about, well, if you're not totally stressed out, or you can go do another CrossFit workout as long as your cortisol isn't over 20 or something like that.
Yeah.
And so this is cool to have a new model. Now, do you know if, for instance, like, because we're a little bit better at measuring insulin resistance and leptin resistance, are the three correlated? So if I'm insulin resistant, I'm likely leptin resistant, or I am leptin resistant. Am I also cortisol resistant then?
I don't know what the exact relationship between all of those would be, but I certainly think that HPA axis dysregulation can contribute to, in some way, to leptin and insulin resistance, and probably vice versa. I wish there was a way of testing for cortisol resistance in the commercial setting. I don't think there is. I think it's only available in research settings. But what's interesting about this study is that I think, like you said, the idea that we can just run an adrenal stress index or any kind of hormone profile where we measure cortisol, and if the person has normal cortisol, we say, okay, you're clear to do, you know, 5 CrossFit workouts a week. We can't really make that assumption, because that test is not going to show cortisol resistance in the white blood cells. I think ultimately, just paying attention to symptoms is a pretty good guide, because if you have this cortisol resistance pattern, you're going to have more difficulty recovering from workouts because that inflammatory response won't get turned off. I mean, working out, especially lifting weights, but doing any kind of intense workout is basically like a controlled stimulation of inflammation. You're breaking down tissue when you lift weights. You're breaking down your muscle tissue, and then when it builds, the idea is that when it builds back bigger and more able to deal with the next stressor, in that case, lifting weights. So that works well if you give the body long enough to recover. if you give the body long enough to turn off that inflammation and then to start the anabolic process rather than the catabolic process of building the tissue back up. But and if you're a healthy person with no significant stress levels and you're not dealing with any chronic inflammatory condition, that should happen fairly quickly and commensurately with the amount of exercise that you did. But if you're dealing with chronic stress and you have cortisol resistance, here's what's going to happen. You'll do the intense workout. You break your tissue down, which is what happens and is the whole point. But the recovery process will be very, very slow and the inflammation will persist. So instead of taking one day or maybe 2 days to get back to baseline and then start building new tissue, stronger tissue, you'll take several days to get back to baseline, or maybe you really never fully do get back to baseline, and then you do another intense workout. So then you break down more tissue and cause more inflammation, and then it's a downhill slide from there. And I see this a lot in the CrossFit community, people who come to me who've been doing CrossFit. And you know, this is not all people who do CrossFit. I'm talking about people who are under significant stress and who are maybe dealing with a chronic health challenge. But the fact is, most of us in this modern world are under stress. And some of us are better at managing it than others, and some of us pay more attention to that than others. But I think this is a very real phenomenon, and it's not just affecting people who, you know, have kids with cancer or spouses with cancer, or people who are socially isolated. It's affecting all of us to some degree or another.
Way to wrap that up. I think it's important to keep learning about it.
So here's another study that I think you'll be interested in, Steve and Jordan. It's about probiotics, and the common assumption is that probiotics work by restoring normal gut flora, and this is partly because several studies have shown that the gut microbiota in people with gut diseases is different than the gut microbiota in people that are healthy. And I've talked about this a lot and I've written about it a lot. And there's certainly a lot of evidence to support that. But over the last maybe, I don't know, probably just 2 or 3 years, there's been some really interesting studies that have come out suggesting another possibility for how probiotics work. And the idea in these studies, or what these studies suggest, is that probiotics don't work by altering the gut flora per se, but through a whole bunch of other immunomodulatory, anti-inflammatory effects. And so these can include antibacterial and antiviral properties, an increase in mucus production in the intestinal epithelium, reducing the migration of neutrophils, white blood cells, into the intestinal epithelium. And all of these properties can basically reduce the neurochemical and impaired motor function found in conditions like irritable bowel syndrome. So there's this study that I saw was on VSL3, which is a probiotic formulation that's very potent. It has several different strains of probiotics at a very high concentration, and it's one of the most studied probiotics in the medical literature. And it's been shown to improve inflammatory bowel disease and IBS and some other gut conditions. So what was unique about this study, really interesting, is that previous studies have looked at this question of, if you take probiotics, does it really change your gut flora? Does it create a permanent change in your gut flora? And a couple earlier studies used stool microscopy to answer that question, stool culture. And I think we've talked about that on a previous show. That's basically where they take stool and they put it under a microscope or they culture it and they look for organisms, whether beneficial organisms or pathological organisms in the stool. And it's not very accurate for a number of reasons, but one reason is that culture can't identify certain strains of bacteria very well. So this study, instead of using stool culture, they used DNA PCR analysis, which is a much more accurate way of characterizing the commensal gut flora. And so they administered VSL3 at a pretty high dose. I think that people were taking about 600 to 900 billion CFU a day, which is a very high dose. And they did that for a period of time. They measured they looked at their gut flora before they started taking the VSL3, and then they looked at the gut flora at the end of the study after they had taken it. And they found in the study that sure enough, the people who took the probiotics experienced significant improvements in a number of different ways. But they also found that the gut microbiota in those people was essentially unchanged from the beginning to the end of the study, which is really interesting, right? It sort of goes against our idea of what probiotics are doing. So these researchers hypothesize that the probiotics, like VSL3 or other probiotics, work by some of the mechanisms that I just described: antibacterial, antiviral, increasing mucus production. They can alter stool and gas formation, and which in turn can reduce constipation and diarrhea. They have anti-inflammatory effects. For example, people with IBS, it's now known that they have an abnormal ratio of inflammatory cytokines like interleukin 12 and interleukin 10, and that taking probiotics like VSL3 can normalize that ratio. Certain probiotics like E. coli Nissl have been shown to affect intestinal motility. They have strong immunomodulatory properties. They can prevent the invasion of pathogens into the mucosa. They can induce the synthesis of antimicrobial peptides. So not only do they have antimicrobial effects themselves, but they can increase the synthesis of antimicrobial peptides. And then they also promote the synthesis of tight junction proteins in the gut epithelium. And as we've discussed on previous shows, a leaky gut or intestinal permeability involves a dysfunction of the tight junctions in the gut. So essentially, this suggests that probiotics, one way that they might work is by tightening up those tight junctions and making the gut less permeable. So, and there are other possibilities too, like the probiotics, when you introduce a large amount of bacteria and yeast into the gut, that stimulates an immune response, kind of in a similar way that helminth therapy or other pathogens have kind of a tuning effect on the immune system. I wrote an article recently about the hygiene hypothesis, or also referred to as the old friends hypothesis, where we co-evolve with a number of organisms like helminths and other organisms that we might have been exposed to in the soil. And those organisms have a balancing and modulating effect on the immune system. And it's possible that probiotics are working in a similar way. So again, from an end user perspective, this might not change things very much because the studies are still suggesting that probiotics have beneficial effects for people with these kind of gut conditions and other conditions. But the mechanism by which that effect is happening are maybe different than we assumed originally.
Yeah, it seems like more of a better justification because it's easy to come across a lot of opinions on the internet who say, well, there's no need to take probiotics because they're only transient. There's no reason to eat fermented yogurt or kefir because it's only transient, the bacteria are. But I've read some of the same research you have in it, and it's really cool to see this stream continue to get wider. And it's going to be really cool in the future when we can start pinpointing certain strains might, you know, come down the line, and if you have a motility problem, you'll take this strain, and if you have a immune modulation problem, you'll take this strain. And I think that's going to be a future that we'll see pretty soon.
Yeah, that's right. And what's going to be part of that is breaking down the various diseases into more distinct categories. Like, I think it's pretty clear at this point that IBS or irritable bowel syndrome is not a single disease, that it's really probably a number of different conditions with different etiologies, different causes. You know, post-infectious IBS, for example, might be a distinct entity where the initial problem was an infection of some sort, and that dysregulated the gut flora and caused a number of other issues because of that. And then there may be another form of IBS that is more mediated by the gut-brain axis. There may be another form of IBS that is more related to small bowel bacterial overgrowth. We're learning a lot more. This thing that we call IBS, it's not really a clinical entity in itself. It's a diagnosis of exclusion, which means that if you go into the doctor and you say, "Oh, I have gas and bloating and abdominal pain," they say, "Okay, well, let's do a colonoscopy and an endoscopy," and they do that. They don't find any ulcer. They don't find any inflammatory bowel disease, and ulcerative colitis or Crohn's. They don't find diverticulosis or diverticulitis. They don't find anything structurally wrong with your gut. And then they ask you a few questions about your symptoms. You're gonna walk out of there with the diagnosis of irritable bowel syndrome, which is kind of maybe a letdown, because you go in there and you say, "Hey, doctor, my bowel is irritable." You go through all these tests, and then they tell you, "Guess what? You have irritable bowel syndrome." You know, and you're like, "Thanks a lot. Thanks for the diagnosis." But when you look at the current scientific literature around IBS, we find that actually there's quite a lot going on there. It just isn't stuff that can be found with a colonoscopy and an endoscopy. We have a lot of evidence for fructose intolerance, strong correlation for fructose intolerance and irritable bowel syndrome, and that's probably mediated by small bowel bacterial overgrowth. And so something like 40 plus percent of people with IBS have been shown to have small bowel bacterial overgrowth. We have disruptions in the gut-brain axis that have been very well demonstrated now, inflammation in the brain, chronic stress response that can cause decreased output into the vagus nerve, which innervates the whole digestive tract. And then that causes, quote, IBS. Then we have dysbiosis, which we've been talking about now, changes in the gut microbiota because of an infection that's either still present. I think a lot of people who are diagnosed with IBS actually have a gut infection. I see that in my practice a lot. You know, they come to me and they say, "I have IBS," and I do a manometric stool test and find out that they have H. pylori, or they have, some other kind of opportunistic or pathogenic bacteria, or they have a fungal infection, which is actually less common. I see a lot more bacterial infections than fungal infections, and it's one of the reasons I think Candida is really overdiagnosed. But my point is there's a lot of different diseases that are right now characterized as irritable bowel syndrome, and getting more specific about what the causes are in each case is the very first step in successfully treating it. Because the drugs for IBS are a joke. They're just, they're drugs that increase motility or decrease motility, or just kind of they're pain relieving drugs. They don't do anything to address those underlying causes, whatever they may be. So I think a combination of getting a lot more specific about what's actually going on, which is happening, at least in the scientific literature, and then, like you said, Steve, getting more specific about particular strains of bacteria or like things, emerging treatments like fecal microbiota transplants or even helminth therapy is kind of the wave of the future here. It's like, in the 20th century, it was all about antibiotics and things that would just indiscriminately kill bacteria. And now it seems like the 21st century is much more about immunomodulation with probiotic organisms or any kind of organisms that can modulate the immune system.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there that you know, the IBS is a joke. I was told it by several doctors, and like you said, the standard treatment is fiber or a couple drugs that don't help at all. But I think with all the digestive conditions, because it seems that if you have diverticulitis or Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, normally you have all of the IBS symptoms as well. And so I find, you know, I really feel bad for those folks who talk to a conventional gastroenterologist who doesn't really help them address their IBS symptoms on top of their, you know, their ulcerations lower in the intestinal tract, because they're really getting the brunt end of the stick there. So
Yeah, definitely. I really, one of these days when I can carve out the time, I really want to write a series on a kind of 21st century view of IBS. You know, like we know so much more about it than the conventional understanding of it. It's such a hot topic in the research literature, and we're really coming to the point where we have the tools diagnostically to identify underlying causes and address them. And like you said, it's really a shame that that's not happening more. And I'm itching to write that series, but I just haven't been able to find the time for it yet. But soon enough.
We're going to need to clone you. Is that okay?
I don't know. I'll have to think about that. So let's move on. I could say a lot more about that, but I'll save some of it for the series. The next study I want to talk about, really interesting. I've talked about low dose naltrexone before, and that's partly what this study is about. It's about a natural treatment for cancer that is being used at, what is it? It's the Integrative Medical Center of New Mexico. And the study basically reports four cases of people with aggressive forms of pancreatic cancer. And most of you probably know that pancreatic cancer is very serious. The prognosis is not good. Usual length of survival is something like 3 to 6 months. And patients with advanced disease rarely live more than a few weeks. And I'm sure most people who are listening to this are aware that Steve Jobs died of pancreatic cancer. So anything that can potentially successfully treat pancreatic cancer is pretty exciting, because it's one of the most aggressive forms of cancer and one of the worst prognoses that you can have. So these folks at this Integrative Medical Center in New Mexico have been using a protocol that involves a few different components. The main two components are intravenous administration of alpha lipoic acid at 300 to 600 milligrams 2 days a week, and 4.5 milligrams of low-dose naltrexone, which is the standard low dose of naltrexone. They also were giving 600 milligrams per day, which is a pretty high dose, of oral alpha lipoic acid, 400 micrograms per day of selenium. I wish they would have said which form they're using. I imagine they're using the methyl selenocysteine form, which is the one that's been shown to have more anti-cancer effects than other forms. And then they're using 1200 milligrams per day of milk thistle extract, which is another potent antioxidant. So they've done this, I'm sure they've done it with more than four patients, but they reported on four patients in particular with pancreatic cancer. The first patient, J.A., had pancreatic cancer with metastases to the liver. So this isn't just pancreatic cancer, it's metastatic pancreatic cancer. The doctor basically told J.A., you know, get your life in order. There's nothing we can do. You probably have a few weeks to live. And he went to the center in New Mexico and he did the protocol. 78 months later, he is in complete remission with no signs of cancer at all and feels like a totally normal person.
Did you say 7 or 8 or
78? 78 months later. So, I mean, considering the usual length of survival for pancreatic cancer is 3 to 6 months, And the usual length of survival for metastatic advanced pancreatic cancer is a few weeks. 78 months is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
The next patient, GB, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and refused chemo because of religious reasons. And she did the protocol and is now alive and symptom-free 39 months after diagnosis at the time of the paper, the time the paper was published. So another really impressive result. JK was diagnosed with pancreatic carcinoma with metastasis to the liver. And she was jaundiced, exhausted, and constant abdominal pain and nausea when she first came to the center. And after a few weeks of the protocol, she improved significantly. And after 6 months, her PET scan showed absolutely no sign of cancer. And she felt normal without any pain or nausea. And unfortunately, and this is very sad, she returned to her home state. She was, you know, she had traveled to New Mexico specifically for this treatment. So she goes back home and her doctors refused to continue the protocol, even though she had basically no signs of cancer. And then she died within a couple of months after going home. And
that's sad.
Yeah, I mean, I have to resist going off on a tangent here. Well, about...
you didn't say. So once they started that treatment, the intravenous drip as well as the supplements, they were on that for life, basically, then?
Yeah, it seems to be that this is not curative. It doesn't look like this. You do this for a period of time, and then you stop, and you're fine. I think you have to continue with the protocol. But
that's not a big deal.
When you compare this to like chemotherapy, you know, you're doing a supplement regime plus low dose naltrexone, which is an extremely well tolerated, very low dose of a medication that has no documented complications or risks, and then an IV of alpha lipoic acid a couple times a week. I think that's a pretty small price to pay to survive pancreatic cancer.
Totally.
But the sad thing is that this poor woman goes home, and even though she has proof that she's, you know, free of cancer and feeling great, the doctors wouldn't do it. It just blows my mind. Nothing makes me more upset than that. It's just crazy. Anyhow, the next patient, RC, had three malignancies. Three, prostate adenocarcinoma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and pancreatic adenocarcinoma. You know, two of those in particular are very lethal. So he improved significantly on the protocol, and he felt so much better that he decided to have surgery to internalize his percutaneous biliary drain, which is something that people use when they have serious gallbladder issues. And he died from complications of the surgery. So the protocol worked in his case, but he got septicemia from the surgery and he passed away. So in all of these cases, the protocol worked extremely well. In two cases, the people are still alive with no signs of cancer or continuing the protocol. In another case, the protocol worked well, but she wasn't able to continue it and she passed away. And then in the fourth case, the protocol worked very well, but the person died of unrelated surgical complications. So pretty impressive. Definitely, if anybody, this is certainly something like if myself or a family member was, or a friend or anybody I knew was diagnosed with not only pancreatic cancer, but just about any cancer, because there's nothing in these results that suggests that they're unique to pancreatic cancer. I would definitely consider this protocol, either going to New Mexico or trying to convince your doctor to do it, because it's not that exotic. I mean, the supplements are readily available. I mean, you could order them from just about any online source. And then the IV alpha lipoic acid is, you just have to find someone who's willing to do a drip. It's alpha lipoic acid is cheap and readily available, and low dose naltrexone is off patent, very affordable and fairly easy to obtain if you find a doctor who's familiar with the oncology literature.
Yeah, Chris. So, I mean, the milk thistle, the alpha lipoic acid, the selenium, those all make sense to me. So what role do you think LDN is playing here?
Yeah, well, let me tell you a little bit more about alpha-lipoic acid because some people might not be familiar with it. And I think it's really interesting in the context of cancer. Alpha-lipoic acid is a cofactor that's active in a number of different enzyme complexes that control metabolism, including the conversion of pyruvate to energy in the mitochondria. So it helps us to transform the food that we eat into usable energy. But it's also really effective as a free radical scavenger, which means it reduces oxidative stress. That's very important in any inflammatory disease, and it's definitely important in cancer. Alpha-lipoic acid also induces hyperacetylation of histones, and histones are proteins that are active in the proliferation of a lot of different cancer cell types, and anything that inhibits histones will drive the cancer cells to apoptosis, which is cell death, programmed cell death. And indeed, human cancer lines have been shown to become apoptotic after exposure to alpha-lipoic acid. So alpha-lipoic acid helps kill cancer cells. Another mechanism that it might work by is that ALA, which is the shortened name of alpha-lipoic acid, stabilizes nuclear factor kappa beta, and or NFKB for short. And when NFKB is activated, it launches the induction of more than 200 genes that suppress apoptosis, and that will in turn increase cellular proliferation, invasion, metastasis, chemoresistance, and inflammation, which are all characteristics of cancer. And so studies have shown that high doses of ALA have been shown to inhibit the activation of nuclear factor kappa beta. Another mechanism is that ALA selectively stimulates apoptosis in cancer cells. And so in other words, it promotes the death of cancer cells without harming normal cells. And that's amazing. That's kind of the holy grail in cancer treatment, right? Is the ability to shut down cancer cells without harming the normal cells. Because that means the side effects of the treatment are not going to be extremely harmful, like as is the case with chemotherapy. So in terms of low-dose naltrexone and what might go ahead.
Okay, quick follow-up question here on ALA. So just for everyone listening, there's no known upper limit for ALA? No side effects?
No, actually, that's a good question. I wouldn't do this. I wouldn't recommend that anybody do this without supervision. And I hope that goes without saying when we're talking about cancer. But I don't prescribe more than 200 or 300 milligrams a day of alpha-lipoic acid unless the circumstances are pretty extreme. And that's one of the things. When you're dealing with terminal cancer, you're a little bit less concerned about any potential short-term side effects from a treatment like this because, you know, what's the alternative? For example, selenium has been shown to be potentially toxic at doses of 400 micrograms a day. But in this case, the benefits of the antioxidant benefit of selenium over this period of time, and because there's so much oxidative damage, those effects are less likely to be a concern. So, yeah, thanks for pointing that out.
Because I guess I'm sure I'm not the only listener of this podcast who's read The 4-Hour Body by Tim Ferriss. And mm-hmm. in that, he actually, his weight loss, his non-stimulant weight loss stack that he recommends includes about 300 milligrams of alpha-lipoic acid per meal. So mm-hmm. I think that's somewhere between 900 to 1,200 milligrams a day. So I was just curious if there was, because when I... being familiar with that knowledge and hearing the study, milligram doses, I was like, wow, it's not quite as high as what I would have thought it would have been.
Mm-hmm. And no, because it doesn't really need to be much higher.
Okay.
I think a lot of times supplements, there's a kind of more is better mentality, you know, with supplements. And that's definitely not always true, because as in the case of selenium, like I was just saying, there's a sweet spot where too little is not good and too much is not good, because selenium in excess can be toxic. So I don't know what the toxic dose of ALA would be, but I would be hesitant to recommend that somebody takes almost 2 grams a day of it for any significant length of time.
Okay.
I'll have to look into that more, and we can talk about it on another episode.
Yeah. Well, I think you pointed out what the most important thing, which is most supplements operate on a U-curve, which means that there's a sweet spot in the middle. And if you're underdosing, you're not really going to get the effect. And if you're overdosing, you're probably going to cause something else to happen that you don't want to.
Right. And as is the case, as we'll see with low-dose naltrexone, in some cases, if you increase the dose, it doesn't work the way that you want it to. So low-dose naltrexone is, as the name implies, a low dose of a drug called naltrexone. And the full dose of naltrexone at 50 milligrams used to be used a while back, I think in the 70s and 80s, as a for opiate withdrawal, like heroin, with people who are addicted to heroin, also I think in some cases with alcoholics. Because what it does at the full dose is it completely blocks the opiate receptors in the brain. And the opiate receptors are what mediate our experience of pleasure. So if you block those receptors, somebody who, like a heroin addict who took 50 milligrams of naltrexone, could shoot up and feel pretty much nothing. Unfortunately, they felt pretty much nothing at every, you know, at all in from anything else in their life. So naltrexone turned out to have severe depression, suicidal ideation, things like that as a side effect, because people who took it, sure, they didn't get the stimulation from heroin and it was effective in that sense, but they didn't experience much of any pleasure in their life at all. But this pretty brilliant doctor named Dr. Bihari back in the 80s and 90s, he was treating HIV and AIDS, or, you know, when hardly anybody else was. And he was also starting to treat cancer. And he discovered that if you used a low dose of naltrexone, 4.5 milligrams, what you could do is, or what it does is it blocks the opiate receptors in the brain, just like the full dose does, but only for a short time. So, for example, the typical way of taking LDN is to take it at about 9 o'clock at night. And then that creates a 2 to 3 hour blockade of the opiate receptors from like 3 to 5 in the morning. And that has the effect of tricking the body into producing large amounts of opiates in response to the blockade. So the blockade happens, the body senses that opiate receptors aren't being activated. It thinks that must mean there are not enough opiates in the body. So then it produces a whole bunch. The reason this is significant is that we now know that white blood cells have receptors for endorphins and opiates, and which suggests they play an immunoregulatory role. Specifically, they balance and regulate the various sides of the immune system. They stimulate T regulatory cells, the TH3 cells, which turn off the inflammatory response, or they have an overall regulatory effect on the immune system. So in the 90s, Dr. Bihari gave LDN to about 450 patients with cancer. And these are folks who had failed the standard treatments. You know, they tried all the other, the chemo and the standard stuff, and they ended up with him. And of 354 patients that he followed up regularly, 86% showed at least a 3/4 reduction, 75% reduction in tumor bulk. And 125 of the patients were reported to, which is, I guess, about 33%, were reported to achieve remission or close to remission. So that's pretty impressive. There's other research that has shown that LDN has slowed the growth of neuroblastoma cells in culture. So that's just an in vitro study, but promising. And then another study showed that LDN plus radiotherapy was more effective than radiotherapy alone for malignant astrocytomas. And malignant astrocytomas are thought to be incurable, also a pretty nasty form of cancer. And in this study, the survival rates at 1 year were higher for people who did the LDN plus radiotherapy than people who just did the radiotherapy alone. So I think it's a really promising area of research. It's like I said, if I had a friend or a relative or a patient that was diagnosed with a cancer like this, it's definitely something that I would advise them to look into.
One last question on this, because this treatment is so heavy on the antioxidant side. There's a lot of papers coming out lately that are saying, I mean, I know they're not, I think they're mostly epidemiological, but they're saying that supplementing with antioxidants could actually be a bad thing. And obviously we're talking about very specific compounds in this study versus what you could classify as antioxidant is, you know, who knows, I don't know, thousands of different things. And I was just curious if you had any thoughts on that.
No, it's another good question. And I'm glad you brought it up, because it allows me to remind everybody again that there's no one size fits all approach, and something that works for people who are sick may actually cause harm in people who are well. You know, it's that's fairly easy to forget, but it should also be fairly obvious. If someone's chemotherapy can help people to survive cancer, but you would never give chemotherapy to somebody who doesn't have cancer, right? And I think that's a more extreme example than this, but if someone's just under extreme amounts of oxidative stress, as you find with cancer, something like high doses of all of these antioxidants might be beneficial. But in someone who's otherwise healthy, it may have undesirable effects. In the same way, you know, when we get questions about diet, like if somebody has no gallbladder and a lot of difficulty digesting fat, they may have trouble with a really high-fat diet, but that doesn't mean someone who has an intact gallbladder and good digestion is going to have trouble with a high-fat diet. So we always have to consider who we're talking about, what the goal is, and even what the length of time is that we're talking about, like short-term versus long-term supplementation, or supplementation for therapeutic uses versus supplementation for short-term or longer-term, just kind of indiscriminate, indefinite use. I use supplements a lot in my practice, but I tend to use them more for a specific goal for a specific period of time than I do just, you know, hey, take this forever. I mean, there are certain exceptions like vitamin D and magnesium, and which I've talked about on my blog, I think that are good, just smart to take indefinitely because they're hard to get from the diet. But otherwise, it's always tailored for who the person is, what condition they're dealing with, and what length of time we need to use them to achieve the effect that we want to achieve.
Okay.
Let's just, here again, I've just talked the whole entire episode and we don't have any time for questions, but we'll do a Q&A episode soon here.
I won't let him talk about any studies next time, I swear, guys.
We've got a lot of good questions. So this last one is quick. And this it's a follow-up on cholesterol, one of our favorite topics. I just saw a post by Dr. Briffa, who was reporting on a meeting that happened at the American College of Cardiology. And they got together specifically, I guess, to discuss the results of a study that was recently published that looked at cholesterol levels 19 years prior to people receiving a diagnosis of cancer. And what they found is that there was a significant association between low cholesterol and cancer. In other words, people who had low cholesterol were much more likely 19 years later or at some period of time later to develop cancer. Now, as we've discussed with the red meat study, we have to remember that this kind of prospective study does not prove causality. It's just an association. It doesn't prove that the low cholesterol was the cause of developing cancer. And in fact, some scientists have argued that causality is the other way around in this situation, that cancer, those patients had cancer and that's what caused the low cholesterol. But there are a few things that argue against that. Number one, the length of the study and the fact that low cholesterol appeared many years before cancer did suggests that reverse causality is not what's happening, that low cholesterol actually preceded the cancer. And then there's another study that found that individuals with a low serum cholesterol maintained over a 20 period had the worst outlook in terms of overall mortality risk. So the authors of that study actually wrote an editorial, or in their conclusion, they said, quote, "Our present analysis suggests that this reverse causality hypothesis is implausible and is unlikely to account for the adverse effects of low cholesterol levels over 20 years. So in other words, according to them, it's more likely that low cholesterol causes chronic disease than the other way around. I just want to emphasize again that the study doesn't prove that. That's the opinion of the authors. And we can't know that just from this data, but as I said with the red meat study, one of the ways that you can use this kind of prospective data and epidemiological data is to generate hypotheses and then try to test them. Now, that's a little bit difficult in the world of cancer research. And I got an email from a graduate student in epidemiology after we talked about the red meat study, and she brought up some good points that I didn't mention when we talked about the red meat study. But it is possible to use epidemiological research or to design it in such a way that it's much where you can draw conclusions about causality that are a lot more likely to be true. As she pointed out, even randomized clinical trials don't necessarily prove anything. And there's a Greek researcher, Ioannidis, I think is, I'm probably butchering his name. I really love his work. But he's written some very interesting editorials. Like I think the name of one of them was something to the effect of "All published research is false." And he's talking about how bias and all kinds of other methodological problems make it very difficult to rely on even the results of randomized clinical trials. So there are ways of designing epidemiological studies that are more likely to yield conclusions that we can rely on. And in fact, there's a set of criteria, the Hill criteria, Bradford Hill criteria, which outline a number of factors that can make the conclusions from epidemiological research more sound. One of them is whether there is a plausible mechanism to explain the finding. And that was one of my criticisms of the red meat study, is that there was no real plausible mechanism for how red meat was increasing mortality risk, nor was there a plausible mechanism for how red meat was increasing cancer, which has been claimed many times. In the case of low cholesterol and cancer, of course, then we might ask what is a potential mechanism that could be contributing here. The truth is, I don't know, but there are a few ideas that come to mind. One is that cholesterol is the building block of vitamin D. You can't produce adequate levels of vitamin D without adequate levels of cholesterol. When you're exposed to sunlight, you convert cholesterol into vitamin D, and vitamin D has cancer chemoprotective properties. Cholesterol is a precursor to all hormone production. We know that hormone and dysregulation of hormones can be involved in cancer. And cholesterol has antimicrobial and antioxidant properties. And, cancer involves oxidative damage and, in some cases, infections, viral infections, and things like that can be a trigger for a cancer process. So I think there are some plausible mechanisms, and there's quite a bit of data. It's very difficult with cancer to do a randomized clinical trial because cancer takes so long to develop. And the other problem with with randomized clinical trials as a means of proving causality is that in certain cases, you'll never, ever see randomized clinical trial because ethically, it just isn't, it's not possible. Like, so for example, if you want to study whether an herb or a medication causes birth defects, the only way you can really do that is epidemiological data. Like, look at a population of people who are taking that substance and see what happens to them in retrospect or prospectively. You can't, it's not ethical for obvious reasons to take two groups of pregnant women and give one of them, you know, a drug or an herb and the other one not and see what happens. Like, that's obviously never going to happen. So I think I was perhaps overly dismissive of epidemiological research and when we talked about the red meat study and didn't convey that there are ways of using epidemiological research, designing it better and so that we can rely more on the outcomes. And the kind of classic example of that is that for many years, there was never any proof that smoking was causally linked to lung cancer. And that was the defense that the cigarette companies use is, you know, there's no proof. There's just this association that people who smoke more are more likely to get lung cancer. But if you apply the Hill criteria to those studies and you demonstrate that there's a plausible mechanism and you go down the list, you can see that actually we can be pretty certain that data is reliable and that it points to a causal link.
Yeah, I think it's really important for, I'm glad you explained it to me again and everybody that's listening because, you know, research of all types is sort of on a sliding scale on how much you should value it. And the unfortunate thing is you can't label a randomized control trial versus epidemiological because it you have to apply that scale individually for every situation, and that's the problem.
That's right.
Where it gets really confusing for doctors and just people like, you know, like me who go to PubMed. So I think that's really, I think one of the best pieces of advice that I heard, and you can go ahead and destroy it if it's not very good advice, but is if you're going to like dissect a study and really take the results of that study to be concrete in your life, you better make sure that the people in that study, that everything that they were doing is exactly who you are. So for instance, if they studied a bunch of young college age women who were taking a supplement and it did some really great stuff, that would not be something that I would take because I'm not a young college age woman. And for instance, if they, this study on ALA and cancer, that's, again, it's not something that I should be doing because it wasn't done exactly on my type of who I am and where I am.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of many variables we need to use when we evaluate a study. And, we've talked about that a few times in this episode, but another classic example is statin drugs. They've never been shown to reduce total mortality in women. And in certain populations of men, particularly men over the age of 65. So the mistake that a lot of primary care doctors and just the general public make is assuming that because statins have been shown to reduce very slightly the risk of total mortality in men with pre-existing heart disease and reduce the risk of cardiovascular mortality in other populations, that we just assume that we can extend those results to women and to men and women who are over 65, which we can't because that's never been shown. So it is a good point, and it's true. It makes it really difficult for the average layperson to kind of piece through all of this stuff. But I don't think that the appropriate response is what I have seen with some people in the blogosphere, just going to the other extreme and saying, oh, well, published research is just unreliable then. You know, we might as well not even pay any attention to studies. I mean, there are some kind of prominent bloggers out there who that's their kind of shtick is that, you know, studies are worthless. That's an oversimplification in the other direction. Just because a lay person is not qualified to evaluate the the quality of a study, that doesn't mean there aren't people that are. I mean, there are a lot of people who work in research settings and even people outside of research settings who are perfectly qualified to evaluate the validity of a study. So we just need to apply those standards and be judicious about the conclusions that we draw from studies based on the quality of the study. We don't need to get rid of all research or throw out all research results. We just need to be better about more conscious of what conclusions we draw and more conscious of what studies we're drawing conclusions from.
Yeah, I agree. There's no reason to just rule out something just because you can't make sense of it. So,
yeah. So, okay, we're a little over an hour here, and we'll get to your questions. We will.
We swear. Well, hopefully you listen next time, because we will do some questions next time. And we want to thank you for listening this time. And please keep sending us your questions. They will get to the show. And you can do that at chriskresser.com using the podcast submission link. If you've enjoyed listening to the show today, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review.